Thank you, Margot. I've heard the phrase a glutton for punishment applied to an individual, but considering the cocktail party and the splendid dinner that we've had tonight, and now the paper that I'm going to read for the next hour and a half, I must conclude that this is a society of gluttons for punishment. And the question I would ask is this. Why do you gluttons want to do this to yourselves? Why do you want to take this punishment? I think that the answer must come not by looking at me, but looking at Don Lipsett. He's the one who had this idea. And what I had proposed, I'd proposed to bring a cigar and to make a very funny talk on a subject that is treated with some high levels of absurdity by the local media and by certain members of the Democratic Party, and especially in the House, namely a talk on Central America and on my experiences with the Kissinger Commission, with Bob Strauss and Lane Kirkland and Mercedes Narros and other arch-conservatives that I knew there. But I was told by Mr. Lipsett that you were a society of very serious intellectuals who wanted to hear about education, a subject on which I'm ill-informed and full of prejudice. Nevertheless, since that's the request, I will try to follow it. If you think it's unfair to you, remember, I have to listen to it, too. So, no one who was reared under the influence of W.C. Fields could accept an invitation to speak to an august society as yours without some reservations. Upon receiving your invitation, I called Fields. Bill, I said, although I called him Mr. Fields as a child when he was abusing me, it was nothing personal, he abused all children. But it finally, when I grew up, it put us on a first-name basis. Bill, I said, what do you think about this invitation? Should I accept this invitation to speak to the Philadelphia Society? He paused as if he had heard an obscenity. And when he recovered, he said, a man who would go to Philadelphia is a man who would refuse on principle to strike a child. When I told him that the meeting was in Chicago, he brightened and he observed that he who is in Chicago cannot possibly be in Philadelphia, and therefore he urged me to accept. So here I am. Now, the title of my address, Stopping the Lemmings, probably has some of you confused but not rapt, for lemmings rivet neither the intellectual nor the man in the street. Except for naturalists, I suppose that the lemming ranks in general interest just a little bit ahead of the newt. What claim do lemmings have to public attention derives essentially from the widespread belief that they periodically herd together and make a mad dash for the sea and self-destruction. Even this dubious basis for notoriety is largely apocryphal. In fact, three of the four species of lemmings pursue the even tenor of their lives in unblemished and undistinguished rodentry. It is only the Norway lemming that has given rise to the popular view. Every 3 years or so, groups of Norway lemmings foregather and begin to migrate with great earnestness. They do not lack all circumspection, however. They avoid, for example, such obvious hazards as fires and large bodies of water. But occasionally, in their enthusiasm for getting from where they are to where they are not, they run beyond the terra firma before them and fall over cliffs to their destruction. This outcome does not seem deliberate, and we may assume that as they tumble through the air, the more thoughtful among them sense that something has gone wrong with what it seemed to be a good idea at the time. Well, that exhausts my knowledge of lemmings. I only brought them up as a medieval bestiarist might have mentioned the whale or the camel leopard. That is, for their signification. The lemming signifieth, as the bestiarist might have put it, massive, mindless, and speciously purposeful behavior that leads to disaster. When we examine our culture, we will be tempted to believe that the Norway lemming, despite its name, is as American as apple pie. Over the years, we have witnessed a succession of lemming migrations by educated Americans who have insisted on fixing things that weren't broken, on abandoning something good in anticipation of something better, or of fleeing the ills they know only to find others that they know not of. Consider the nuclear freeze movement. The relation between this movement and the activities of the Norway Lemming is one for which the word similarity is simply inadequate. The mot juste is identity. In this movement, we find the same sudden and inexplicable rush of mass behavior, the same joyful charge toward an unknown destination, and the same cliff waiting unseen. And although I hate to introduce politics into a gathering of such austere and disinterested scholars as are assembled here tonight, it has been clear since the New Hampshire primary that the Democratic Party this year has captured the Lemming vote. Many examples of Lemming behavior will occur to you, and I will not continue this catalog. In the remainder of my remarks, I will address education, in which I find the Lemming ethic widespread and enduring. In education, the Lemmings are always rushing off to an unexamined future. The most important thing about the future is that it will come with or without our help. It is the inevitable consequence of the present. The next most important thing about the future is that it cannot be hurried without destruction or disruption of the present. People who think favorably about the wave of the future and being in its vanguard and rush there are impatient with the present and wish to escape it. In such people, the taste for the future is usually allied to a chronic case of utopianism, and the two in combination can be fatal both to culture and society. There is regrettably no area in our society where the taste for the future and the utopian itch are more pronounced than in education. Education, traditionally thought to be the conservator of knowledge and of culture, has been transformed into an engine of change. This is true at all levels of education and has been accelerated in higher education by foundations which pour hundreds of millions of dollars annually into projects for untried and often demonstrably mindless innovation. In contrast, foundations provide little or nothing in the way of support for proven programs, programs of proven value. If I were to approach a foundation executive and say, Boston University has a splendid program called the College of Basic Studies. In this program, we admit students who would typically be rejected by universities of our quality, for they have horrible SAT scores and bad high school grades, exposed to a two-year core curriculum in the humanities and in the sciences, taught by a team of gifted and devoted faculty, five in number, 80% of them complete this program and transfer. Those who transfer into our College of Liberal Arts graduate 2 years later with a higher grade point average than students admitted to that college as freshmen with vastly superior entering credentials. I want to offer each year a sabbatical for one of the five faculty members, for all five of the faculty members on one of our college's seven faculty teams, and I'm requesting funding for that end. After the foundation executive stopped laughing, he would explain that no foundation supports ongoing programs or any aspect of an operating budget of a university. Relishing seeing me hoist by my own petard, he would say, you have convinced me that the College of Basic Studies is far too good to need foundation support, and that would be the end of that. On the other hand, if I came in and I asked him to fund a pilot program in which the students in this college, remember they were admitted despite the deficiency in their academic background, if these students are allowed to design their own curriculum, and I want to fund a pilot program to enable them to design their own curriculum, the proposal might very well be funded, even though such a proposal could not possibly improve the college and might easily destroy it. Innovation is the shibboleth in the world of educational foundations. When innovation is what is funded, innovation is what one gets. This is not to deny that there are areas in which innovation is needed, and universities and foundations should work together with responsible discrimination to support promising innovations. But indiscriminate support of innovation for its own sake has been the dominant move in philanthropy, in the humanities, and in the social sciences. Consider the change in the college curriculum since 1945. In 1945, we saw the appearance of the Harvard Red Book. It set a standard for coherent and substantial college curriculum. It was widely adopted and followed at many institutions, both state and independent, throughout the entire country. Then many schools and colleges, including such distinguished institutions as Brown, for example, decided that making no specific requirements for graduation was vastly superior to making any requirements for graduation, and each student was left to design his own program. Eventually, even Harvard followed on the trail of the Lennings. By the mid-1970s, the curriculum of the institution that had once provided leadership for the entire nation was in such disarray that Dean Rosofsky at Harvard put a distinguished faculty committee to work in the development of a new core curriculum. His committee's report contained the following statement. We do not think there is a single set of great books every educated person must master. This is a statement of the greatest cultural importance. We do not think that there is a single set of great books every educated person must master. That means that a person may graduate from Harvard or from anywhere else, presumably, without having read the Bible or Homer or Aeschylus or Sophocles or Shakespeare or Plato or Aquinas. Students who have not read the Old Testament or the Iliad will no longer know that David and Jonathan or Achilles and Patroclus were paradigms of male friendship. They may, however, still resonate feebly to the tie that binds Starsky and Hutch. To criticize such a program is not to engage in the sort of Harvard bashing that is always tempting and is lots of fun for less fortunate and perhaps envious college presidents, of whom I'm certainly one. The time at which I become most Marxist in my leanings is the time at which I think of how pleasant it would be if all of us were to share the endowment of Harvard. And I would like to remind Derek Bach that it's far better, more blessed to give than to receive. It is rather to suggest that we have so lost our way that what is arguably the greatest university in the world has partly lost its belief in higher education. Most colleges and universities cannot afford to do that. And certainly, many more do it. If many more do it, the American people, who have not entirely lost their capacity for common sense, are liable to find out. But I would minimize the problem of lemming behavior in education if I continued to focus on higher education. For the remainder of my remarks, I shall concentrate on the public schools and the problem of education in that area. The disarray of American education at all levels is the result in part of the cooperation between university lemmings and primary and secondary school lemmings. By relaxing the requirements for college admission in the name of innovation, higher lemmings reduce the demand of high academic performance and encourage the lower lemmings over the cliff of debased secondary school curricula. Once the secondary schools abandoned the rigorous requirements for graduation from high school that had characterized the American high school of the 19th century and well into the 20th century up to the 1950s, the qualifications of high school graduates were understandably lowered. Our primary and secondary schools have not lost their way merely because of the encouragement of colleges and universities, however. The public schools have also suffered from the consequences of foundation-financed innovation, and state and federal governments have provided funds for accelerating the future. And primary and secondary education have suffered from an additional plague. In fact, the decline of the school curriculum began well before the deterioration of the college curricula. Slowly but relentlessly, following the turn of the century, the untalented followers of John Dewey conceived the notion that education was a science and therefore a fit subject for research. Since proper scientific research involves experimentation in a laboratory, schools of education that sprang up in the wake of Dewey's influence at Teachers College began to operate laboratory schools with experimental curricula and before long, they were involved in the operation of the public schools through the administration of practice teaching and curricula design. The futurists had no patience with the schools as they were, for the schools reflected the past. Experimental programs flourished in the schools as vehicles of research, and shortly the curriculum of our schools began to resemble nothing quite so closely as the fad of the year club. Textbook publishers joined in as they realized that the more often textbooks are revised, the more money can be made. Textbooks of exemplary quality gave way to new ones of dubious merit. I exclude in part the sciences in which such rapid advances are made as to require continual revision of textbooks. But even here, however, innovation for the sake of profit has often been the enemy of quality and substantially increases the cost of providing for the textbooks for our public schools. A peculiar quality of educational innovation and experimentation is the relative lack of interest in the assessment of performance. About 10 years ago, the National Council on Accreditation of Teacher Education, NCATE, the agency responsible for handling programs of teacher education, inspected the very distinguished Master of Arts in Teaching program at Reed College. Their report contained an illuminating sentence. Incate was, it said, impressed by the quality of the students that Reed had recruited. That was the good news. The bad news was that Incate had serious doubts about the admissions procedure that had been used to produce these excellent students. The proof of the pudding, according to Incate, was not in the eating or even in the assessment of the eating, but in the assessment of the recipe. This fascination with process over result is endemic in educationism and encourages the practice of no-fault pedagogy. When results are less important than methodology, it is impossible to judge whether an innovation has succeeded or has failed. The educationist's reluctance to take achievement or the lack of it seriously is especially notable in their reaction to the ongoing decline of the SAT scores. Between 1972 and 1982, the SAT scores in 22 states where the SAT is predominant as the admission test, the other predominant test being the ACT, declined from 937 to 893. But educationists have refused to see this as an index of declining quality in our schools. Their first line of defense is that the decline in the SATs does not measure anything taught in the schools. All the verbal and mathematical SATs assess, they claim, is verbal and mathematical potential, not performance. It should be obvious that children are not born with linguistic and mathematical capacities already developed to the point that they can take the SAT test, much less perform well on it. Schools are our principal instrument for converting the intellectual potential into intellectual performance. Were it true that the schools did nothing to develop these skills and to transfer potential into performance, we would have an admission that would be a stunning self-indictment. But bad as the schools are, they do attempt to develop intellectual potential and convert it into intellectual performance. And the decline, therefore, in the SATs measures the decline in their success. Most observers, in fact, accept the existence and the significance of this decline. But they offer a series of excuses for it. That the schools do not have enough money, that classes are too large, that teachers are not paid enough, that the increased proportion of minority students accounts for the decline. And the claim most often made, that the larger proportion of high school seniors taking the test has introduced persons of less intellectual ability into the testing process, and they explain the lower aptitudes. Let us examine the last charge first. The first problem with it is that the proportion of high school seniors taking the SAT test has not been increasing, and that would seem to be a very serious objection to that point of view. Between 1972 and 1982, it declined by a half percentage point. But if we consider the 1982 SAT scores for all 50 states, we find that those states which score higher than 950 on the combined SAT scores have less than 20% participation rates, while those who have greater than 35% participation rate score lower than 875. And so that would seem explain this. But as it happens, the states in the low participation group on the SATs merely happen to be those states in which most students take the other test, namely the ACT. And that explains the low participation rate. If we examine them all together, the participation rate could account at most for 1.4% of the variance in the SAT scores in the states in which that is predominant, and at most 14% of the variance in the ACT scores in the states where that's predominant. Moreover, the decline has not been across the SAT scale, and this is the most important single factor. Between 1972 and 1982, with the total population essentially constant, the proportion of students scoring above 700 declined by 15%, the proportion scoring between 600 and 699 declined 13%. The numbers that scored between 500 and 599 declined 21%. And these declines were compensated, not surprisingly, by an increase in the number of students scoring under 400 of 21%. Now, this 400 or below, 400 is the lowest you can get, and the people that scored below the minimum, having only 400 as their score, increased by 21%. Now, this movement is what the Commission on Excellence in Education meant by the rising tide of mediocrity. It is the rising number of young people who fail to reach their full educational potential. We cannot evade the alarming conclusion that something is wrong with the schools, that the schools are failing to develop the intellectual capacities of the students. None of the other excuses offered for the decline of the SAT score or the state-by-state difference in the SAT score fare any better under scrutiny. We are, for example, regularly told that if the schools are to improve, the teachers must be paid more. Public school teachers have, in fact, suffered terribly from inflation in recent years. But if we analyze the statistical relation between teacher salaries and SAT performance, we find that teacher salaries can account for exactly 0% of the variance. There is simply no correlation between teacher salaries and the performance on SATs. And probably that is explained in part by the motivation that brings people into teaching. The good teachers go in for idealism and for idealistic reasons rather than for the money anyway. We are also told that if schools are to get better, classes must be smaller. But the intractable fact is that while the effective SAT scores declined 7.5% nationwide, the pupil-teacher ratio, the measure of class size in any rational system, declined from 22.3 per teacher to 18.9, a percentage improvement of 15.3%. There is a weak negative correlation between class size and scores. Class size could account for about 6% of the score variation in SAT states and for about 11% of the variation in the states taking the ACT, but that is a small role in this. We're also told that the SAT scores are lower in states with a higher proportion of minority students, which is a code word for blacks and Hispanics. There is a fairly high negative correlation between the proportion of minority students taking the test and the scores on the test. In fact, minority enrollment by itself can account for about 31% of the variation in SAT states and about 35% in ACT states. But unless the excuser makes the racist argument that blacks and Hispanics are inherently less educable than whites, these figures don't excuse anything. They simply demonstrate that the schools are failing even more with black students and Hispanics than with white students. As it happens, although the states with the lowest SAT scores also have the large majority minority enrollments, there is no constant link between the two. Many states with comparatively high minority enrollments have substantially higher SAT scores than other states with significantly lower minority enrollments. They also have lower dropout rates than some states with lower minority enrollments. Some blacks and politicians and educators of both races have used the SAT scores for blacks to discredit the SAT examination itself. This, in my judgment, is a very short-sighted tactic. If the inferior performance on SAT tests does not represent inferior educational opportunity, but if it indicates merely inadequate tests, then we lose the best national measure for the educational abuse of minorities. Hispanics and blacks are on far sounder ground when they insist on the validity of the SAT and the ACT tests, and then demand that education be provided that will bring blacks and Hispanics up to the same standards of white students. If they simply discredit the test, they will wipe out all the evidence that demonstrates the full extent to which they have been disadvantaged by the educational system as it presently exists. We're constantly told that good schools cannot be attained by immense increases in funding. Yet the total funding per pupil can account for only about 9% of the total of the score variance in SAT states and about 16% in ACT states. And that, again, is a very small proportion, and there is no isomorphic relationship between the two. One of the most striking facts to be learned from even a casual study is that there is a high negative correlation between dependence on federal funds and on SAT scores. 31% of the variance, and 31% is a large percentage, 31% of the variance in SAT states can be predicted simply from knowing the federal dependency, and 64% of the variation can be predicted in the ACT test, ACT states. This does not, of course, prove that federal funds are bad for learning, But it does suggest how ineffective federal spending has been in fulfilling its promise of upgrading the quality of schools. To summarize, if we analyze SAT and ACT scores for all the variables cited by educationists who argue that the fault lies not in themselves, but in their stars, we discover that the correlations that should exist if these claims were sound do not exist, and the relatively high SAT scores are compatible with each of them in their turn. Statistical graphs of these variables show that there are a number of so-called outliers, states that on one variable or another are very far from the average, and they are very instructive and worth examining carefully. When we consider reliance on local funding, for example, we find interesting outliers. New Hampshire derives 83% of its school support from local government. That's non-state government, non-federal government. That's something, that's just about double the national average. Nebraska follows close behind in this regard. New Hampshire has the highest SAT scores in the SAT states, and Nebraska is the fourth highest in the ACT states, and is a bare half point behind the leader, which is Wisconsin. Yet in total funding per pupil, New Hampshire is 28th in the nation, and Nebraska is 21st in the nation. It is only reasonable to ask whether these factors may be related, especially considering that the highest scores in both groups of states are in the states that derive excess of 35% of their funding from local sources. Now, I think that this is a highly significant factor because local funding is best for a kind of commonsensical reason. A typical school superintendent in New Hampshire, where the average SAT score is 925, gets most of his money from his customers. That is, from the parents and the students in his schools. The typical school superintendent in Hawaii, by contrast, where the score is 100 points lower, gets most of his money from the state and almost all of the rest from the federal government, almost none locally. State and federal bureaucrats do not spend their own money on the schools and are, in consequence, far less demanding evaluators of the schools than taxpayers who must pay for them out of their own pockets, or parents, the success of whose children depends upon the quality of those schools. School superintendents in New Hampshire must fight for their appropriations from select men, notorious in their frugality and in their demand to see results. Taxpayers and parents are not inclined to excuse a school system that fails to teach their children to read and to write. Rather, they are outraged by such fiscal and intellectual profligacy. Bureaucrats, by contrast, interpret failure in a school system as merely an occasion to require additional state and federal funds. The evidence I have surveyed suggests strongly that there is no easy and simple explanation for which schools perform well and which do not. And one factor is certainly the quality of individuals who function in one state or in another. School superintendents as individuals can make striking differences. A state superintendent can make a decisive difference. So that counts. But one factor that seems to make a serious difference is that of local control and local funding. It does seem to be a dominant factor in those school systems in which high scores are achieved. But against all the state-by-state variation in performance is the fact of the overall decline in the SAT scores, particularly in scores above 600, and the increase in the dropout rate. These are national problems. Indeed, one might describe them as national crises. These are what can be described as factors that have placed the nation at risk. They are factors that work to undermine the effective education of this nation, and they cut across all state boundaries. What produces this situation, of course, is not limited to what's going wrong with the schools themselves, but to what is absent in the background in the sustaining network associated with the schools. The statistical evidence is clear that the family where education begins and where it must be sustained is in trouble. Between 1955 and 1981, the percentage of two-parent families with children under 18 declined from 89 to 80%. That's almost a 10% decline. In the same period, the number of families with only one male parent increased from 1.1% to 2.1%, almost a doubling. And the number of families with only one parent, a female parent, more than doubled and rose from 10% to 18% of all families with children under 18. This is not simply a function of divorce. In the same period, the number of births to single women, which we used to call quaintly illegitimate births, rose from 500,000 to 750,000, while the total number of births declined from 4.1 million to 3.7 million. In fact, between 1950 and 1980, the proportion of births to unmarried women jumped from 4 to 17% of the total. This was, moreover, a period in which the practice of birth control and the practice of abortion were steadily on the increase. It would be foolish to deny that there are excellent single parents and that there are dreadful married ones. It would be even more foolish, however, to deny that on the whole two parents are better than one and that a single parent family is likely to provide a far poorer environment for the initiation and sustenance of education than a two-parent family. It is also reasonable to conclude that a child so little in control of herself as to produce a child of her own while she's still a teenager and unable to provide for it is not likely to be a thoroughly competent parent and to be able to guide the educational program of that child. It is essential, moreover, to note that in the two-parent family where both parents are at work, there is less likelihood of providing an environment that encourages education, much less than in a two-parent family in which one parent remains at home for the nurture of the children, to devote himself or herself full-time to their care, feeding, and education. Over the past decade, the proportion of our children who benefit from living with two parents has declined, of course, and those who live with one parent have increased, but at the same time, we have had a drastic increase, a shocking increase, in the number of families, two-parent families, in which both parents are now at work. It's hard to come to the exact figures on this, but we do have a pretty clear figure. The number of working mothers increased from 26% to 46% in this period of time, and it would be astonishing if a society in which 46% of the mothers were at work was a society which could as effectively nurture the education of the oncoming generation. The decade of the 70s in which the SAT scores declined was one marked by the deterioration of parental responsibility as measured by another index, and that is the index of increase in abortion. Between 1975 and 1980, incidentally, on this subject, I speak not as a Roman Catholic. I happen to have been predestined to be a Presbyterian. between 1975 and 1980, the number of legal abortions performed on women between the ages of 20 and 24 doubled. It is fair to say that children who have been aborted are not likely to take the SATs or to affect the figures. But the growing acceptance of abortion on demand mirrors a declining acceptance of the responsibility of men and women for their children and a declining willingness to accept the inconveniences and travails of parenthood. It seems clear that our increasing tolerance of abortion on demand, with the planted axiom that the child is no more than a part of the mother's body, the mother presumably giving birth to herself, with no independent existence, whose removal involves activity that has been described as no more serious than that of blowing one's nose, has led to a general coarsening and degradation of our understanding of the obligations of parents to their children. Another force at work that must be reckoned with in any consideration of the decline of education is television. Let us leave aside the question of the content of television, although that content alone is enough to explain the trashing of the juvenile sensorium and much of the deterioration in our society. But for the sake of the argument, let us assume that it is nothing worse than a neutral wasteland, merely a cultural desert devoid of moral and spiritual cesspools. In 1983, the Nielsen Organization estimated that the average child between the ages of 2 and 11 watches approximately 24 hours of television a day. That's 3 hours and 25 minutes per day, or that's one full day a week, one 24-hour day a week, or 20% of the child's waking hours. The best that can be said for this is that it conditions the child from an early age to deal with information in terms of sound and pictures rather than in terms of written language. The worst is that it encourages a mindlessly passive ritual of indiscriminate consumption that is hostile to the development of intellect and body. One can also measure the decline of industrial and economic productivity in a society in which adults watch at least that much television per week. Realism compels the conclusion that many of the forces assaulting education are beyond our control. We may deplore television, but it seems impossible in a democratic society to do very much about it. We may stand appalled at the decline of the two-parent family, but aside from reforms in welfare legislation that removes the present incentive for welfare mothers to raise their children without a father in the home, we probably are stuck with the continued deterioration of the family in this society. It's a deterioration that afflicts all affluent societies, apparently, whether they will it or not. We can do little but hope that in time the pendulum will begin to swing the other way. In the meantime, the self-indulgence and irresponsibility represented by the trend in abortions is not likely to be reversed. Legislation prohibiting abortion did not prevent it in times when abortions were still associated with high risks of sterilization and even with death. Legal prohibition is not likely to prove any more successful with regard to abortion than it was with regard to alcoholic beverages. It will be a long time, if ever, before the moral coarsening brought about in this generation of luxury has been sufficiently reversed, and it will only be reversed by adversity, has been sufficiently reversed to sustain laws which limit the prerogatives of the me generation. In my view, the current state of the abortion law is to be ascribed to the moral coarsening of our period rather than the other way around. There are, however, factors in the decline of our schools which are in our reach, about which we can do something, which we can make into a program of action. And one area is the restoration of a national standard of excellence. The proper role of the federal government in education, it seems to me, is to serve as a kind of national bureau of educational standards. We badly need the American equivalent of the British O and A level examinations, standardized tests that in fact measure what has been going on in the schools and what has been going on in the pupils who study there. Examinations of this sort would give the public in each school district a means of tracking how their schools were succeeding in providing these essentials in a way that can be compared objectively with the performance in other schools. The passage of O-level exams would signify genuine satisfaction of minimum requirements for graduation from high school. Successful passage of A-level exams would signify competence for admission to four-year colleges and universities. At the present time, I suspect that few college seniors indeed could pass the A-level exams. The A-level exams would also provide a measure for minimal certification of teachers, at least in their own subject matter. We should, moreover, strive to revive local control of public schools. Within the diversity of this country, there is a broad agreement among parents and taxpayers as to what constitutes the essentials of primary and secondary education. Salvation does not lie merely in transferring all power from the federal government to the state government. State governments, through their regulations of the public school education, have been instrumental in delivering the curriculum into the hands of bogus experts in the education schools. Worse than that, by establishing certification standards for teachers almost entirely in terms of education courses, that is, courses having little to do with education, they have given the education schools a virtual monopoly on the supply of teachers and placed obstacles in the way of the teaching profession for intelligent students who will simply not accept the intellectual and spiritual indignity of the typical school of education curriculum. The willingness to endure 4 years in a typical school of education constitutes an effective negative intelligence test. Nationally, the combined SAT scores among students intending to study education is 80 points below the national mean. 813. Just at the borderline of educability. It will probably decline still further as schools of education, in a desperate effort to sustain their declining enrollments, lower their standards still more. The only reason why I question that last statement is I don't believe that's possible. Most of them practice open admission at the present time. It is possible to buck this tide. We have done it at Boston University by accepting substantially lower enrollments in our school of education in return for higher quality. And that has cost us over $6 million in terms of tuition revenue. Between 1970 and 1982, the undergraduate enrollment in our school of education dropped 80%, not by design, but by on purpose, from 2,332 to 387. At the same time, while the national combined SAT scores dropped by over 40 points, the score at our school dropped only 3 points and is now a respectable 1,039, over 200 points higher than the national average for students planning to major in education. We're proud of this accomplishment, but we are aware that it cannot be replicated nationally. If it were, the national teacher pool would in a few years be inadequate to educate the increasing numbers of students that will enter our schools in the years ahead. There's one area in which we're never surprised, and that's about the number of children who are going to come to school or are going to come to college, because it takes time for them to get there. Between 1973 and 1981, the number of births, after undergoing a 12-year decline, in which we reached the curiosity level in the number of live births in this country, we had a decline that was so severe it has threatened the stability of higher education. But within this short period of time, it is now once again begin to rise by 16%. 500,000 more children were born in 1982 than were born in 1973. And those increased numbers are beginning to appear in the primary grades. We'll have to have teachers for them. If we are to have sufficient numbers of teachers of adequate quality, we must break the monopoly that the schools of education have on teacher certification. Somewhere, there must be an intelligent and courageous governor deeply committed to education and possessed of the political skills necessary to pass a highly controversial education bill over the self-serving opposition of the National Education Association. He would do his state and his country a great service by enacting a 10-year moratorium on certification requirements. During that period, schools would be free to recruit qualified college graduates with majors in academic subjects, whether or not they had had any education courses. From a vastly increased pool of talent made up of persons attracted by the ideals of the teaching profession and its intellectual and moral challenge, schools would be able to develop a teacher corps of significantly increased quality. I believe if we could get this experiment underway in one state, improvement of its educational program would be so swift and dramatic that parents and taxpayers in each of the other 49 would demand and get its establishment there. I am as opposed as anyone to the practice of trying to solve problems by throwing money at them, but I have become persuaded that a part of our educational problem is the low salary paid our teachers. This problem was recognized recently by a report of the Heritage Foundation and is simply beyond dispute. It is not simply that public school teaching is the lowest paid profession that requires a college degree. We could probably live with that, for we need an important component of idealism in the self-selection of individuals for the teaching profession. Teachers must be people for whom a significant part of the reward is the job itself, that challenge to develop young minds and young personalities. But teachers have been cruelly afflicted by inflation. Nationally, over the decade from 72 to 82, the average teaching salary declined by approximately 20% in real terms. More important, the salaries of science and math teachers suffered a serious decline relative to the salaries available to persons competent in these fields in private business. The differential has initiated a serious brain drain. In 1980-81, 4% of our science and mathematics teachers left teaching for better-paying jobs. That's in one year's time, in business and in industry. In the same year, fully a quarter of the public school teachers were not certified in their subject. Given the casualness of certification standards, this means that many lack even minimal systematic exposure to mathematics, much less college-level competence in the field. The most obvious solution to the problem is to establish higher salary scales for teachers in disciplines where business and industry create higher market levels and salaries, and to allow part-time teaching by persons employed in business who can teach at the beginning or at the end of the school day on a release time arrangement with their employers, or by calling into service as teachers retired engineers and scientists from industry who are still in good health and have the desire to teach. Such moves would doubtless be vigorously opposed by the NEA. Should their opposition be successful? If it is, the self-interest of a relatively small union will have taken precedence over the interests of the taxpayers, the parents, and the nation. To the extent that salary increases can be given across the board to teachers of demonstrable competence in their subjects, that would be highly desirable. Within broad limits, one gets more or less what one pays for in personnel as well as in commodities, and we will not be able to raise the quality of our teacher corps on the cheap. I do not believe, however, that as a political reality, the taxpayers will be willing to make this judgment without knowing that the quality of teachers is in fact improving and that their competence is assured. Initiatives to improve salaries will have to go hand in hand with other programs, such as the moratorium on education course requirements and an opening of the teaching profession to demonstrably qualified persons from business, from industry, and from homemaking. The most important reform I would advocate for our schools would be a major devolution of authority from the states to the local schools. I believe that state aid is a valuable means of equalizing serious differences in tax bases, but it should be provided in the form of block grants for revenue equalization rather than as funding for whatever novelty the educationists have recently concocted. And it should be limited to what is necessary to provide basic education in the poorer cities and towns. Coupled with decentralization, we need a program of parent and taxpayer education to undo the decades in which the educational establishment regularly told their customers that they did not know enough to have an opinion on the quality of their schools, and that if Johnny couldn't read, it was probably Johnny's fault. And besides, reading isn't so important anyhow. I can think of no American who could make this case more effectively to the American people than the great communicator himself. And I would hope that President Reagan would take that task of education as an important part of his second term. I may have seemed a pessimist tonight. I am one, for this is an age in which there is much to be pessimistic about. And to be pessimistic is sort of an indication of intelligence and of understanding what's going on. But my study of the decline in the public school education convinces me increasingly that the fault is, after all, not in our stars, but in ourselves. And that is, relatively speaking, grounds for qualified optimism. Thank you. Thank you.